Hey, dear fellow law entrepreneurs, welcome to episode 396 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyron, your host once again, and today we're going to reach back into the archives one more time for a timely episode that aired previously. It's coming up towards the end of the year, and that means the end of the tax year for most people, and so taxes are on everybody's mind, you know, around the holidays. It's kind of a weird combination of focuses, but regardless, taxes are an important aspect of running a law practice. And back in November of 2019, on episode 190, I had my good friend John Pontius on the program, and he's a tax attorney here in the Washington, D.C. area, as you will hear. And we had a pretty wide-ranging conversation about the issues of taxes and accounting and IOLTA management and the like. John's a terrific speaker, spoken many times before bar associations, and a good friend of mine, a good friend of my family's, frankly. And so I'm delighted to have him back on the program by way of the magic of technology. So without any further delay, here once again is my friend John Pontius.
Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 190, almost 200, of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyrell, your host once again. And today my guest is John Pontius. Now, I've known John for a great many years. He's a local attorney here in Rockville with offices in Washington, D.C., and he's a tax attorney. And I recently had the pleasure of listening to him give a presentation at the Maryland State Bar Association's Solo and Small Firm Summit on Accounting 101 for Solos. And it was so well received, and I thought so elegantly stated, that I knew right away that I got to tap my friend's shoulder and get him on this program so that the rest of you can hear his very sage and wise advice about accounting, bookkeeping, IOLTA, trust management, entity formation, and the like. Some very fundamental questions that we solos and small firm practitioners need to address when creating our business. So without any further delay, here's John Pontius. John Pontius, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hello. Great to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you with us today, John. Although I know your backstory, why don't we take a couple of minutes and have you talk to our audience about who you are and how you got to be where you are today.
Absolutely. I founded Pontius Tax Law about 2 years ago. I'm a sole practitioner with offices in Washington, D.C. and Rockville, Maryland. As you may guess from the name of my firm, Pontius Tax Law, I focus entirely on tax matters. And within that space is primarily what we call tax controversy, where I represent individuals and business clients with sensitive and serious matters before the Internal Revenue Service and state taxing authorities.
Yeah, I think attorneys who focus in tax law and speak to other attorneys about the issues regarding taxes are a unique breed, because it requires an understanding of a part of the law and math and regulations and stuff that not all of us did well at.
Yeah, I agree with that. It was one of those things where when I went into law school, I didn't quite have an area that I knew I was going to do, kind of went in open-minded. But for me, that intro federal income tax class, I enjoyed. And there were many people, Neil, like yourself, you're in good company, that did not like it at all. So I just kind of thought, as a career calculus, that I kind of liked this area, at least in the beginning, and it grew into a love of this area, but as well as just other people not wanting to do it for a variety of reasons, as you mentioned, and thought it would be just a neat area to do things other people don't do. So I'm not competing with everybody who's super smart, who's also an attorney.
Well, I mean, I think it's really smart in that regard. I mean, I enjoyed my first tax law class, until the exam came.
Okay.
You know, then I wasn't as thrilled with it as I thought it was. But attending the class and lectures and reading the cases, I liked that part. But I figured, okay, the exam wasn't my high point. And if you're going to make mistakes, tax law isn't an area where you want to make mistakes. You don't want to make mistakes in the law anywhere. But it seems to me that was fraught with the opportunity to have a problem. So
yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think tax is a little bit different than most other areas, and it's primarily statute based. And for a person like me, I kind of like that sort of precision. But other areas of law, there's a lot more. Case law and things like that, where there's wiggle room with tax, it's a little bit, as you said, more precise, which I enjoy, but it's not for everybody.
Now, a lot of times, tax issues come up in other practice areas. Obviously, when I was doing family law, that certainly was the case, and now estate planning, to some extent, even more, although there are different kinds of questions, different kinds of issues. Do you find yourself interfacing a lot with other attorneys from different practice areas?
Yeah, it's kind of a bit of a mix. And attorneys are great potential referral sources because they kind of know their client very well and sort of can see potential pitfalls. And usually when a taxpayer client were to get a letter from the IRS or the state, this attorney would kind of say, this is perhaps a bit out of my expertise area and sort of refer them over to me. But it's been a variety of different types of attorneys, family law, business law attorneys, a lot of sort of other people that either at smaller or solo firms that don't do tax. But I also get some referrals from very large firms, some even in DC, that just the matter, while very important and stressful for the client, is just not who they typically serve. These large organizations tend to serve big corporations. So I have this sort of niche where individuals and business owners are a good fit for me and not for everybody else. So it's one of those things where it's a variety of sources and attorneys are a large portion of my referral source.
Now, I know you do largely tax disputes, but do you also advise on strategy regarding tax issues?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, it's sort of my biggest value add is the controversy side. In terms of the advising side, I do that as well. The problem is with most individuals and small business owners, it's just the economics that they try to sort of do it themselves. And for most part, they people do it well. I deal with a very small percentage of people that get caught up in a variety of tax messes. But it's one of those things where I love to advise people, but just the economics, most people think they know what they're doing. And they've muddled through for many years. And sometimes with the business side, when they grow beyond a certain threshold, they need to perhaps get advisors, CPA, attorney, et cetera. And they don't always know that until sometimes something goes terribly wrong and they unfortunately have to pay for it.
And that's when they come to you.
Yeah.
I know in my own experience, I'm sure this is true for other attorneys who are listening, that, if I'm advising a client with respect to their estate plan, oftentimes one of the primary questions is, what are the tax implications of this strategy? And, that's an area where I think unless, if you're an estate planning attorney, unless you've actually spent a lot of time analyzing the tax law and the changing nature of the tax law, geez, I would really be hesitant to answer that question. I would always want to bring on a referral partner who can provide that kind of expertise. Is that something that you see?
I haven't seen as much of that. It's one of those things where there are a lot of sort of generalist tax attorneys that do sort of a little bit of everything. And, and this sort of estate area is one where there's a lot of folks that kind of are in this space. I kind of know the rules at a high level. And generally speaking, it's one of those things where there's large exemptions under the current law that it would have to be someone with a very large estate. And if the estate were to be that large, I think I would perhaps even in that case for trust and estates, refer them to someone else that I know that really just focuses on that area just because the dollar figures are so big and the stakes are so high.
Yeah. In that regard, the issue has become a lot simpler with the current administration and the current state of the federal exemption being as high as it is. So the threshold question I get when I speak to clients a lot of times is, you know, is your estate worth more than $11 million?
Right.
When they stop laughing, I said, okay, well, then we don't have a whole lot to worry about in terms of complex tax strategy. We can avoid that issue.
Yes. Yeah. That's, I think at a high level, I would agree with that 100%.
Yeah. So recently, I had the pleasure of listening to you present some of your expertise and knowledge to the Maryland State Bar Association Solo and Small Firm Summit Group. And so I wanted to review some of that with our listeners, because I think there was some really important information that you shared that we haven't actually addressed on this podcast. And I'm a little bit embarrassed to say that, because some of it is so fundamental to starting a solo or small firm practice. So let's dip our toe in that a little bit. You know, one of the things that comes up so frequently right from the very beginning is what type of entity to create for your law practice. And what I see so many times is well-minded attorneys who aren't really analyzing that question sufficiently enough, and they end up with a default position that may not be in their best interest going forward. So let's talk a little bit about the options that attorneys would have for creating their business entity, and what are some of the trade-offs.
Absolutely. Yeah. So as you mentioned, Neil, if one were just to sort of hang their shingle tomorrow and start their small firm or their solo practice, that would be called a sole proprietorship. And there wouldn't be any legal protection or limited liability from that sole proprietor, which is a little bit tricky because, you know, with professional services, one still needs to have professional liability coverage, but that limiting of liability outside of negligence on behalf of the attorney is usually something most people are interested in. But if for the sole proprietorship, that default option there, that person will report income and expense on a Schedule C of their Form 1040, and then that income, of course, would flow through to a state or DC tax return there. If it was to be a more of a small firm with a partnership, that would also just be a default. If there's two or more owners, those taxpayers report their income on a 1065, and that income and loss would flow through to the partners. There is no tax paid at the partnership level. However, what I see mostly for people that are just getting started, if they're a single solo practitioner, would be a single member LLC. That would still, on the tax side, be reported on a Schedule C of a 1040. For these sort of initial options, you're not going to need to get an EIN unless you have employees. It may be a good idea just to sort of get that as one's getting started, just to sort of have that flexibility in the future to move forward. Getting an EIN is a fairly simple process, can be submitted online. An EIN is going to be most critically needed and required if that organization were to later have employees. And then to get a little bit further ahead in entity selection, if the firm were to grow, it could be a multi-member LLC. In that case, it would, an EIN would be required, be reported on a Form 1065. Some solos may want to be a S corporation, and that would be reported on a Form 1120S. And the benefit of that is instead of all of the net income to that owner being subject to payroll taxes, that owner would be able to pay themselves a reasonable salary, issue themselves a W-2, and just pay income tax on the rest of their income from their workers, for example, and not have to pay this larger payroll tax. And of course, the other final option is a C corporation. I don't really see that too much with law firms, but that would be subject to two levels of taxation, once at the level of the entity on a Form 1120, And then once the dividends are issued to the ownership, there'd be another level of taxation. So from a tax perspective, it's least efficient, but for other businesses that may have large capital and they want to sort of keep that money and reinvest it, that's another option.
Yeah, I know it's a difficult question to say which is the best choice, but what's the one that you see most often being implemented for solo and small firm practitioners?
Yeah, if it's going to be at least for the short term, a sole practitioner, single member LLC, that's the way to go forward. If it were to be a partnership at that point, it could be, you know, a multi-member LLC. And it's fairly straightforward. One can go on to SDAT through the State Department of Assessment and Taxation in Maryland, and different jurisdictions have a different version of that. But one would just sort of fairly simply create that entity online. If one were to go as a partnership, it could be, like I said, a multi-member LLC. And it's critical, if one were to do that beyond the scope of this talk on tax, would be to have a good operating agreement between those partners that understands rights and responsibilities, income, taxes, things like that.
That's a whole nother ball of wax.
Right.
And it's really an area where most partnerships, I think, have a challenge. You see it all the time where there's some different level of expectation about how the partnership's going to work, and either they work through it or that ends that partnership, which brings me to, you know, a follow-up question is how challenging or difficult is it to move from one entity formation to another? Say if you start off as a sole proprietor and then you move to a single member LLC and then maybe you add a partner, you want to become a multi-member LLC or some other type of formation. How difficult is that to change?
Yeah, not too difficult at all. So the sole proprietorship, really there's no forms that are filed anywhere. That's the default. If one were to go to single member LLC, one would go online to that state's licensing website. Maryland is SDAT, State Department of Assessment and Taxation, but it could vary from different jurisdictions. And potentially, and you know, I'd say 15, 20 minutes, one could, if one's familiar with sort of the technology side, walk through and become a single member LLC. If one wanted to then convert that to a multi-member LLC, it depends on several things. One could sort of wind down the solo LLC and close everything, or one could sort of just make additions to it, i.e. a name change. So instead of just name one, it'd be name one and name two, perhaps, LLC. And then with that, they're usually going to want, you know, a copy of, if there is an operating agreement, things like that to be filed with the state so that, you know, it's clear in terms of who's responsible, who could potentially be the resident agent, things like that.
Right.
But not too difficult.
Okay. All right. You know, I think one of the things that terrifies attorneys about this whole subject is the concern about staying current with their tax obligation. And, you know, first off, determining what is my tax obligation and how often or when do I have to pay it. Now, some people kind of resort to, I might turn all that over to my accountant or to my bookkeeper. I don't even think about it. But for those who want to have kind of a bit of an overview or an understanding, what are some of the issues with respect to the payment of taxes?
And that's such a really important question, because for most folks that are going out on their own for the first time, they were most likely a W-2 wage earner, like most people, an employee. And that type of withholding was largely done, you know, by their employer. And it's kind of set it and forget it. And then ideally, each year one files their return and gets a little refund, and the system kind of moves on. So estimated tax payments is really an important topic, and I see this all the time with my controversy clients, especially businesses, you know, even individuals as well, where they owe some money perhaps, and as a baseline, and the IRS and state jurisdictions aren't going to negotiate or even resolve the case until one is in current compliance. That means filing all the returns and paying the current year taxes. But to get into the more direct question for the estimated tax payments, it's a little bit technical, but I'll try to keep it at a high level. When one is self-employed, one needs to make estimated tax payments on a quarterly basis to the IRS and any state taxing jurisdictions. Generally speaking, a surprise for most solos when they first go out there is the self-employment tax. Not to get too technical, but the self-employment rate is around 5.3%, and that includes Social Security about 12.4% and Medicare about 2.9%. So generally speaking, when one is an employee, half of that is withheld from that employee's paycheck, and then half is paid by that employer. So that sort of difference of about that, you know, 7.5% is sort of an additional tax that most solos aren't going to be really tracking that first year, perhaps. So we talked about this during the summit as well. How does one calculate this? Well, you take the prior year's tax liability, multiply it by 110%, and divide it by 4 quarters. The problem is when one is starting off for the first year, it's hard to sort of project that income for the year. I would recommend overpaying, because underpaying, you know, is going to lead to potential penalties and interest. But it's one of those things where you have to work with your bookkeeper and accountant to try to, as best one can on a quarterly basis, try to figure out where the business is. But that level is perhaps too much for some to follow it. And they just sort of perhaps take a more broader approach and get a very large refund at the end of the year. But if that refund gets very, very large, one may want to sort of figure that out so you're not giving an industry loan, you know, right, to the IRS in Maryland. But the alternative is what always hurts people, is when they don't pay it fully, hit with large penalties and interest. So it's kind of a tricky thing.
Yeah, it is. And it takes a little bit of foresight and planning to manage.
Yes.
You know, and that's where a good accounting system and, you know, the advice of a good bookkeeper comes into play. And, you know, I remember we had, Pat Yevix as a guest on our show way, way, way back in the beginning. And she was the former chair of the solo and small firm section of the Maryland Bar. And she named three things that every attorney must have. I invite our listeners to go back and listen to that podcast to find out all three. But one of them, and I think it was number one on her list, it might have been number two, was get a good bookkeeper. There's nothing that can help a solo better than hiring a good bookkeeper. And whether that's somebody that you retain locally and have, you know, face-to-face, hands-on relationship with, or whether you use a virtual bookkeeping service as I do with, again, another guest of ours, Susie Q Bookkeeping, a little plug for them. If you do it online or virtual bookkeeping, it's really important to get that process or that relationship in place so that you can address things like estimated quarterly taxes.
Oh, I agree 100%. And I think that advice is so critical. Some attorneys think, I want to do everything. You really got to stay with, you know, what you're good at and generating revenue, because one can get in the weeds and spend countless hours trying to set up debits and credits and chart of accounts and do it wrong, and ultimately having to hire someone and start all over from fresh. And, you know, that sometimes frustrates people. And I say, you shouldn't have even tried, you know, just get the professionals. And at the same time, though, try to learn and understand what they're doing. And that's going to sort of take a little bit of time, but get a trusted bookkeeper and then try to do the best you can to learn, knowing that it's going to not be overnight, but just sort of over a period of time, either through calls or emails or however that relationships work, to try to get a better understanding. Just because at the end of the day, these tax responsibilities are going to fall on that small business owner. And but the delegation is critical to these bookkeepers. Yeah.
Yeah. I know in my own journey along those lines, that aside from listening to the advice of somebody like Pat Yevix, one of the motivating factors for me was I wasn't getting the information from my accounting system. And I used QuickBooks, still mm-hmm. use QuickBooks. I wasn't getting the information that I wanted from that system, nor was I smart enough to know how to manipulate it to produce mm-hmm. the information that was necessary to guide me in managing my firm. And so hiring a bookkeeper to do that and to make sure that my accounting system was capturing the information properly and reporting it properly was critical to being able to make sound business decisions.
I agree 100%. Yes, because as you sort of said, making business decisions, and if one doesn't have good books and records, one could really go in a wrong direction in terms of perhaps advertising, marketing, even how much one's charging for, you know, services. You know, is the economics sort of working in a way for yourself, for the client, you know, for the future growth of the firm? Yeah.
Yeah. And today, you know, having that bookkeeper coordinate with my tax preparer has eliminated that whole issue as well, because the tax preparer tells the bookkeeper what information they need in what format. And usually that's pretty standardized in terms of the, what your accounting system can produce. And so the two of them get together and pretty much, you know, I don't have to do a lot except review it and approve it. So it makes the facilitation of preparing the tax returns even, you know, that much simpler.
Yes. And that's the way it should be, Neil. That's wonderful to hear your insight onto your experiences. Yeah, I'd agree with that, right? If the bookkeeping is done well, tax season and tax filing should be as painless as it can be. It's still some time. There may be some small little questions here and there about something where perhaps the software didn't link with, you know, and a few little questions, but it should be just a few small questions versus massive, you know, what are we doing here? It should be just fine-tuning things at that level. Yeah. And then making best decisions for, you know, next year, saying, ooh, well, this tax law changed. And okay, for next year, maybe let's try to, you know, do this maybe a little bit differently, or just, you know, plan accordingly. I always say, make your good business decisions and let the taxes sort of be sort of secondary. You know, you don't want to make a great tax decision and reduce the size of your practice. You know, that wouldn't be a good idea. But some people get so wrapped up into taxes and trying to save a few dollars in taxes that, you know, it really depends on the economics as to, you know, strategies and cost benefits and things like that.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby, the number one client communication solution for growing legal practices. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Ruby creates exceptional experiences for your callers and website visitors. They take messages, screen and transfer callers, schedule appointments, perform new client intake, confirm details with outbound calls, and can answer in English and Spanish, and a whole lot more. Just like an in-house receptionist, only better, because they turn every ring into a relationship. Ruby can work full-time, part-time, or as a backup, and you can change your instructions anytime with their top-rated mobile app and online dashboard. Plus, Ruby integrates with tools such as Clio, Lexaclara, MyCase, and Rocket Matter. It all adds up to more opportunities and more time saved. In fact, 90% of legal professionals who use Ruby capture more billable hours than the national average, with many recording double or more. That's 5 or more billable hours per day. To experience the Ruby difference for yourself, visit get.ruby.com/ELE. That's get.ruby.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, for up to $150 off your first month. Imagine you, powered by Ruby. As a law firm owner, you take responsibility for driving more revenue for your firm. But how much of that revenue ends up as bottom line profit? Ryan Kimmler, the net profit CFO, helps law firms drive more top line revenue to bottom line profit. His two game-changing tools are the scorecard, so you can actually know what your numbers are and can make informed decisions, and the action plan, so you know how to get your numbers where you want them to be and drive more net profit. To learn more about Ryan, check out episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can get a free profit acceleration call by going to go.oncehub, that's O-N-C-E-H-U-B, go.oncehub.com/profit. I will also tell you, just as an aside, I am a client of Ryan's. I've been working with him for the past 6 months. Frankly, ever since he did that episode with me, I signed on with him to be a client. And I've been thrilled with the kind of information and insight he's been able to give me. So do yourself a favor. You know, get that free call and check out Ryan Kimmler at netprofit.com.
Now, I just got back from the Clio Cloud Conference in San Diego. And one of the things, you know, I'm contemplating changing my practice management software over to Clio. I know you are a Clio user. One of the advantages or one of the justifications maybe for making that change on my part is the integration of QuickBooks with the Clio practice management software. That working for you? Are you happy with that integration?
Yeah, super happy. My bookkeeper is also a QuickBooks Pro person, so she goes into QuickBooks and kind of does everything. But largely, only I have a Clio subscription, and everything pulls so seamless from Clio to QuickBooks that she doesn't even need a Clio username and password to go in there. So that sort of shows how smooth it's been. Then you layer on top of that with Clio LawPay, which is who I use for credit card processing. So it just kind of goes pretty smoothly. Of course, there's expenses to using credit cards, but as a solo, you got to be efficient and need a small set of fees versus waiting for checks to arrive in the mail and things like that. And it's just so smooth. It integrates well. It's a great user experience. It's secure. It's easy. It's one less thing to worry about.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the motivator for me personally. And as we dive into my own personal transgressions here for a second, because of all these many years, my accounting platform and my practice management platform have been disconnected. Mm. And so I've made that work through either brute force or some other external integrations, but that's not optimal. And I'm looking for a seamless solution. And it sounds like I'm getting closer and closer to that.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, the other thing with Clio, I don't even use all of Clio. I'm somewhat technical. I think you're even better with technology than myself, Neil. And from what I've heard is that one could use even more robust tools besides these sort of more basic tools in order to grow one's firm with Clio. There's other programs out there that I think are very good plug and play as well if one were to be more technologically minded and wanting to perhaps use those to grow the firm.
Now, I know some folks have some concerns about, I don't know if privacy is the right word, but at least control in terms of using a bookkeeper or an offline CPA or someone who has access to their financial system. And I know that can be a concern for some attorneys. What are some of your suggestions in terms of best practices, or is that
sure.
worry misplaced?
No, I think, you know, these worries are well placed because there are these stories that people hear kind of whispered at cocktail parties from time to time about, you know, the very small percentage of firms where, you know, the bookkeeper, the CPA or some financial advisor made bad decisions and, you know, there was fraud involved, embezzlement, things like that. Those are few and far between. I would say, you know, hire a reputable bookkeeper, you know, do your due diligence, recommendations, referrals, you know, check up on them to see if they're good. But then getting into the weeds of, you know, what role they play, I think it goes back to the principle of good internal control. You want to have separate people doing separate things so that, you know, they're not writing checks. They don't have access to your bank account. They don't have access to your check. They don't have access to your credit card, you know, et cetera. So that what their role really is just sort of as an additional separate, it's called My Accountant portal within QuickBooks for them to be able to see everything like that. But at the end of the day, you sort of have to trust your professional and then perhaps on a quarterly or some other basis, monthly even, review what they've done just to make sure that, you know, everything makes sense. Some people are more set it, forget it, and they sort of put more trust in their bookkeeper. And I think that's fine as well. It really comes down to a personal preference and that relationship and what people feel comfortable with. But as long as one has internal control, you know, the worst that could happen would be the bookkeeper perhaps make some mistakes and you maybe get a new bookkeeper. But in terms of a financial cost, hopefully it wouldn't be more than just having to perhaps have some new person look things over. But if one sort of stays on top of this, you know, it should be sort of routine after a period of time in terms of the workflow that you have with this bookkeeper so that, you know, things are being done in a way that the attorney understands, being done properly and smoothly.
Yeah, my sense is that there's enough internal controls and firewalls within the platform such as QuickBooks and and Clio or whatever tools you're using to help guard against, you know, some of the worst case scenarios. I find it kind of interesting that, you know, similar to computer security and people who have concerns about using the cloud, they're the same people who have no difficulty, you know, walking away from their laptop at Starbucks to use the restroom and leaving client information on the screen or available to any passerby who may go by. The same, I think, sometimes is true with accounting systems. People are concerned, but I don't want my bookkeeper to have my accounting system, but my office manager has check writing authority in my firm. And I just find that kind of contradiction to be illustrative of kind of the problem.
Yeah, and I think on the technology side, as you mentioned, there are sort of systems with Clio and QuickBooks, as I understand it, where one can kind of go back in time. So if one were to kind of pinpoint that something went sideways or really bad with either of those software products, I think there's the ability to kind of, you know, and I'm not super technologically savvy, to sort of go back and sort of, you know, reset things from that point forward, or to be able to go back and fix things, you know, as well.
Well, let's talk about the 600-pound elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about, and it's the third rail of accounting and law firm management, and that's the IOLTA account. You know, I tell the story frequently that one of the reasons we do this podcast is because so little information is presented by law schools and even bar associations about financial management of a law firm, such that, you know, I had friends of mine who lost their license because they couldn't manage their IOLTA account properly. And that's because they'd never managed a checkbook ever before. You know, and so asking them to manage not one, but two, and one of which is the important IOLTA account, was just overwhelming to them, and they ultimately made a couple of bad mistakes, and that cost them. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, about the trust account and some of the issues that we need to absolutely pay attention to.
Yeah, and I agree, Neil, that this is sort of an area that people don't really speak about often, and kind of people kind of say, I think I'm compliant, or they haven't audited me yet, and it kind of, you know, different levels of comfort and risk and these types of things. But at a high level, you know, as you mentioned, the interest on lawyers account, also known as IOLTA account, also known as a trust account, retainer, et cetera, that's not the attorney, small firm owner's money. That is the client's money until that money is earned. And then, you know, on my workflow on a monthly basis, I would take the money from the IOLTA after I issued the client bills and then move it into my operating account. And that's sort of the flow there. But you really have to be careful with that IOLTA funds, that, you know, things like commingling, keeping very good records, you know, keeping those records for a period of time, that can trip people up. But to going back to that principle of the bookkeeper, one should be able to, track that, you know, through QuickBooks as well, just like another account, and the practice management software also should be tracking that account. So at a high level, software can really make an attorney's life easy. I think the biggest issue is just on a monthly basis, you know, I create a little Excel spreadsheet of all the funds I move for all my clients from one to the other, and then I make that transfer, and trying to tick and tie out those little pennies sometimes can be a little bit tedious, but that's how I kind of get the comfort that I'm doing everything properly. And then my bookkeeper on sort of a monthly or periodic basis sort of double checks all of those things. And, you know, sometimes there's a penny or two up or down, and I kind of fix that. So it's good to be thorough on the front end and then have someone sort of periodically look it all over to make sure that one's compliant.
I know when I brought my bookkeeper on, one of the things that she was, you know, ecstatic about was to discover that when I had set up my accounting system, I had set up the trust account to use sub-trust accounts for each client. Which is a function of QuickBooks, so that it rolls up collectively to your trust account balance, but the money is segregated for each client. Whereas some attorneys I know have not used that subtrust function in QuickBooks and instead have been managing the allocation of funds to specific clients using the note field.
Yeah, that seems like that could be just
which is
complicated with, and potential problems on that. I mean, I've spoken to all different types of solos that some they don't even do retainers because they think it's too tricky. I would recommend doing retainers just because you want to ensure that when your client is happy and the problem is solved, that you're getting paid versus them taking a trip and then waiting and waiting. But then I also know other people that kind of do Excel spreadsheets and all types of things. But, you know, as one grows in the size and busyness of one's schedule, that the more one can automate and, as you said, get into these sub-accounts so that it just makes it easier to double check. You know, you zoom in on your QuickBooks on one screen and maybe the practice manager on the other way, and you kind of can see on an account by account basis, you know, check, check, check. And on a monthly basis, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, that reconciliation that the bookkeeper does with everything, bank statements, credit cards, and, you know, QuickBooks and Clio to try to just tick and tie all of those numbers out is really critical to making sure that the bedrock is strong.
Yeah, for sure. And even if you're, you know, I've had some attorneys say to me, well, I don't really do retainers because I do fixed fee billing. And I asked them, well, when do you collect the money? They said, well, at the end of the matter. Oh, well, that to me sounds risky.
Yeah, I think that is risky. And I think on the other side is people that say I'm doing fixed fees and I'm taking the fees up front. That sounds like something that should be reported in an IALTA account. So there's all different types of people that, especially solos, who don't necessarily know all of these intricate rules, and they kind of just heard from somebody else who did things, and that person may or may not be doing things the right way. Yeah. So I'd always encourage people to kind of spend a little bit of time looking at the rules. I know they're tedious in their own jurisdiction to make sure that they're compliant, because the idea is to create practices and procedures within the firm so that it's simple and straightforward and done the right way from the beginning. Because when people get busy, you know, have to circle back and turn off the clock for client work, and to do IALTA account reconciliation for months in the past is extremely tedious, and it's hard to remember all of those different bills and all those amounts. So to be avoided if possible.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, the one thing that I share with folks, and again, most of my education has come from making a mistake and learning from it. So this is, I share this because, you know, it was a mistake that I made. But look, you can make a mistake in your IALTA account. It's not the worst thing in the world, but you need to fix it and you need to be upfront about it. And I'll give you a perfect example. I one time was depositing a client's initial retainer and was in a rush and hurried and grabbed the wrong deposit slip and deposited their retainer into the operating account, which caused my IALTA account to bounce when I wrote a check against it. And the first thing you do is have a heart attack when you realize, oh my God, I've got an insufficient funds notice from my bank on my IALTA account. If that should ever happen to anybody, the first thing you do is call bar counsel up front and let them know that there was a mistake and this was what the mistake is. You'll probably be asked to document it and provide proof and show that you've corrected it, but it doesn't have to be the end of the world.
Yeah, I think that's smart. I mean, a lot of people, when they get into trouble with things, they kind of, you know, don't know how to fix it, A, and then B, don't know who to ask for help. And I think you took both steps, A, fixing it, and then B, sort of communicating to the right parties to sort of to help with all that. So, yeah, I agree. That's great.
So let's wrap this up then about talking about some of the best accounting practices that you would recommend. I know one of the points that you made at the presentation you gave was that to use your practice management software to track your trust funds, and I would say practice management / accounting software to track all your trust funds.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the baseline, a building block for good, especially IOLTA records as well as all records. I agree. Yeah, 100%.
And how about billing? Let's talk about. I know your practice is to do billing once a month, right?
That's typically it. Yes. However, as I kind of mentioned in that summit presentation, what I try to do is just bill on a monthly basis. However, there are some cases where they're under a lot of pressure from the IRS to hit certain deadlines. So in limited situations, if I'm getting close to that retainer being exhausted, I will in those cases bill on a quicker basis, usually early on in the cases. But yeah, generally speaking, the rule is I bill on a monthly basis.
So if the client is getting close to depleting their retainer, you may issue a out of schedule bill.
Yeah, and I put that in my attorney-client agreement that these things can happen, because I always find it's better to communicate that sooner versus doubling down and, the client, especially early in the relationship, is, maybe caught off guard. It just really depends, in my practice, how hard the IRS pushes back. And sometimes these things go smoother and sometimes it's very difficult. So I try to give them an idea of what this may cost, but, it's variable. So,
I know Allison Williams, who's been a guest on the show before and is a very successful attorney up in New Jersey, who also runs a program called the Law Firm Mentor. She advocates for a lot of her clients billing twice a month on a biweekly basis, that perhaps you only collect the money once a month or you're looking for payment once a month. But for some of her clients, she's issuing billing statements. I mean, I think maybe all of her clients, she's issuing billing statements every 2 weeks via email and using her automated system, which is the only way you could do it with that kind of frequency, because her view is that clients want to know the burn rate or the spending rate in many cases so that they know what to expect. The challenge is when they get a bill at the end of the month that is for a large amount and kind of shocks them. And you want to make sure that they're on board with what's going on and that you can show them, how that billing statement was arrived at.
Yeah, I think it depends on the firm in terms of that practice. I think and I know, Allison, as well, I think you had an organizational meeting there, conference type of mini conference with Allison. I met her last year,
yes.
And she's great. It seems like her practice is a little bit larger, and I think she's got the admin staff to issue those twice a month or better technology to sort
for
of
sure.
make this simpler. So for me, issuing the bills, it's like a half day process. So I don't think I would necessarily do the twice a month, but I do agree with the importance of sort of communicating and sort of getting clients, the expectation during the month, while I'm sending the email with the client on an update, say, by the way, this took a lot longer. The IRS is really being difficult or fighting on this issue. And as a result, it's taking us more time. But yeah, I agree with that. I think another thing that Allison mentioned that I've implemented as well, Neil, is I think she mentioned as well to get a credit card authorization on file. And if they do not replenish the retainer within 2 weeks, that they have authorized the firm to run their card. And I think that's very helpful sort of for me when I'm initially talking with clients to sort of let them know, expectations of the firm and expectations of sort of getting paid here. And most of the time, it never goes to that level. But for some people, maybe they're older and they're not as familiar with the technology. They just sort of send an email to me in writing saying, run the card. And it's just a matter of just finding a way that works for each firm to get paid. And there's many ways of getting paid. But for me, having that backstop of the credit card in which if they haven't replenished within 2 weeks, I've got that sort of ability. Now, if the card bounces, kind of know who you're dealing with, and you may have to make a tough decision as to whether one wants to go forward or not with that client. But that's just another sort of tidbit I'd share.
Yeah, I had forgotten about that little piece of advice. That's really well put, and I think for some people, it would solve a lot of problems for sure.
Yeah.
All right, John. Yeah. Listen, we could go on forever here, but we're up against the clock. Why don't we let our listeners know how they might reach out to you if they want to follow up on any questions they may have regarding the information you've shared with us today?
Yeah, probably the easiest way for them to reach out to me is through my website, www.pontiustaxlaw.com, or they can find me on social media, on LinkedIn or Facebook, and I'm happy to speak with others about accounting systems, things like that, tax entity questions, as well as if they maybe have gotten a letter from the IRS or their clients have, and they're not quite sure at what point is it important to bring in an attorney. I'd be happy to sort of have a quick call with these folks and try to maybe give them some advice and maybe guide them the right direction or maybe help them out professionally as needed. Thanks so much, Norm.
Yeah, I will also share with our audience that John's presentation at the Bar Association meeting was really well received and was really engaging, as you can tell, I think, from his conversation here today. So if you're looking to have a similar type presentation at your local event or maybe even not so local, reach out to John. I think you won't be disappointed. So, John, thanks ever so much for taking the time to be with us today, and we'll be in touch.
Thanks so much, Neil. Take care.
Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode, our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them, and I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client, and then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So, very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.